Blog Talk Radio.
Blessings and greetings, greetings and blessings, blessed souls. We're alive because we want to stay alive and toward Chaim. Instructions of life toward Chesed. Instructions of kindness toward Rachamim. You're now tuned into Soul Class 390, contemplating upon the Book of Daniel. And we're broadcasting live right now at about 9:48 Eastern Standard Time here live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA, Unifying Souls, actually. Originally, at the beginning of this day, we had planned to do our flagship program of In Search of Authentic Torah with our co-host and Rambam teacher and advocate and disseminator of Maimonides' teachings, Dennis Ryan, and hopefully would have had as well Ben Noah, activist Ron Williams. However, something occurred to my family, nothing serious, and we were unable to do the show. The program. So anyway, I had a little bit of free time right now, and with that being said, I figured I'd do something a little bit impromptu, because recently I'd been contacted from our blessed brother Yaakov James out in California, who wanted to ask me a question about chapter 5, verses 25 through 28 in the book of Daniel. And I know this teaching is very interesting to many blessed souls. Basically, chapter 5, verses 25 through 28, and let's read them right now. And quote, and this is the writing that is inscribed, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Ufarsin. And Daniel then proceeded to interpret it for Belshazzar, the wicked king of Babylon. This is the interpretation of the matter, as written in Scripture. Mene, Creator God has counted your kingdom and has brought it to an end. Tekel, you were weighed on the scales and found wanting. Ufarsin, and your kingdom has been broken up and given to Media and Persia. But before we go further deeper into chapter 5, I think it would be fitting to bring that whole story into some sort of historical context within the total book of the book of Daniel. And Yaakov, Achi Yaakov, you have patience with me. We'll hopefully get to those verses. But I want to go all the way back to chapter 1, verse 1 in the book of Daniel, and put that in a context. First, if we read from the verse, chapter 1, verse 1, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, or Jehoiakim, yeah, and I'm not going to pronounce it in the anglicized way, who at that time was the king of Judah. However, during the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, came along Ba Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavo Yushalam Ba Yatzar Aleha. And Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Now, the question that comes out or arises in my mind, blessed souls, is that there is a lot of talk in various faiths aside from the Abrahamic, Isaiah, Jacobic, Israelic, Mosaic perceptions and elucidations on the Torah, this idea of Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and many people read into this day that we are in Babylon. So what is this Babylon that some would say we are in right now? Babylon, in the language of Hebrew, is called Bavel, which is connected to a Bilbul of confusion, in the kingdom of, or the kingdoms of confusion. So let's try to look back at the original Nebuchadnezzar as he appeared in the Tanakh, in the book of Daniel. And then each person can try to understand how the concept of Babylon, Bavel, applies or does not apply, or the mindset of Nebuchadnezzar, ancient king of Babylon, Melech Bavel, applies or might not apply today. So, with that being said, Nebuchadnezzar, according to the Al-Sheikh, who was one of the famous oral Torah elucidators, was forced to come in person to end the revolt because the Yehudim, the Jews of Jerusalem, were not just bowing down to the armies and the vast armies of Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. The people of Jerusalem refused to surrender without a struggle. And Nebuchadnezzar was actually forced ultimately to besiege the city in order to conquer it. Now, In this perspective, according to the Al-Sheikh, it would be normally expected of the conquering ruler to not only have ransacked the city, but also kill the inhabitants of the city. But Nebuchadnezzar made a move that is historically noted. What he did was he took the Melech of Yehuda, the king of Judah, Jehoiakim, into bondage, and he took a portion of the Kelim HaKadoshim, the holy vessels of the temple, because in fact the temple had been destroyed by the human means of Nebuchadnezzar's army under his leadership. However, the Al-Sheikh wants us to understand that Nebuchadnezzar's conquest of Judah or Yehuda was not because of his military know-how, but rather an act of Ashkocha Protis, divine providence, that the Creator's supervision of the universe dictated that while Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, was conquered and the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, the very misdoings of the Yehudim, of the Jews at that time, did not warrant that they be totally destroyed. Now in chapter 1, verse 2, it's written that the Creator, and the name used for the Creator in the second verse in chapter 1 of the book of Daniel, is the name which is spelled Aleph, then followed by a Dalet, followed by a Nun, followed by Yud. This was the name that was revealed. The name of the Creator was revealed to Abraham, Father Abraham, Avraham Avinu, which is because of the prophetic consciousness of Abraham, Avraham, this name has come to be elucidated by Israelite sages throughout the ages as a means by which a person can actually feel a personal relationship with a Creator who is personally supervising his or her daily activities, their hourly activities, in fact, every activity during their waking moments or even their sleeping moments. So this name of the Creator also is the embellishment of the attribute of kingship, that the Almighty Creator is the source of all kingship. And therefore, in this verse where it says that the Creator or Lord gave Jehoiakim into the king of Judah, into his hand, being the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, and part of the vessels of the house of the Creator, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, which is another name for the country known as, or the empire of Babel, Babylon. We shouldn't be surprised by that, because as we see today, the USA is also known as the United States of America. So that a country should have two names doesn't only apply today, but also applied in ancient days. Babylon is also identified as Eretz Shinar. And there it says in chapter 1, verse 2, that Nebuchadnezzar brought them, both Jehoiakim and the vessels of the temple, to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, I mean the God that he worshipped, the idolatrous God that he worshipped, and the vessels he brought into the treasure house of his God. And Rashi explains that the fact that Nebuchadnezzar brought both the vessels back to Babylon and ultimately into the temple of his God was a way of him expressing thanks to his idols. Now, we just mentioned that Babylon, or Babel, is also known as Shinar. Why is Babylon also known as Shinar? Well, in the earlier depiction of the flood, which is brought out in the book of Genesis, the land was called Shinar because those who died in that great flood were deposited there on the account of the fact that Babylon, Eret Shinar, has low-lying terrain. And also, the word Shinar is derived from the idea of Shininaru, that they were shaken out. The dead of the flood were shaken out into this low-lying land. Now, when it mentions here in chapter 1, verse 2, that Nebuchadnezzar brought the vessels of the temple into the treasure house of God, the Malbim mentions that Nebuchadnezzar, even though he had just celebrated a great victory for him, because Israel was, the nation of Israel was a world power, not necessarily in military prowess, but because of their spiritual capabilities, which was recognized by the nations, whether the other nations liked it or not. After Babylon's defeat of Israel, specifically in the land of Judah, in the area of Jerusalem, although, of course, winning a war can expand one's consciousness, Nebuchadnezzar experienced a reduction in consciousness because the Malbim and the Al-Sheikh assert that Nebuchadnezzar should have realized that his victory was a consequence of the Creator's punishment of the Jews of those days. But even though he could have seen that in light of the context of his expanded consciousness of having just defeated the Jews and Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, he attributed his victory to his idol. And this verse is brought down here to explain that eventually the great victory that Nebuchadnezzar and his successors felt that they had accomplished, or Nebuchadnezzar and then the tradition he gave over to his son, which is Belshazzar, the eventual misfortune that they would experience was because of the very fact that they had taken those vessels from the temple. And that Nebuchadnezzar ultimately brought down destruction upon himself when he brought them to his temple. Now, this is not a new thing, a new concept, that those who took the temple vessels would experience retribution. In the time preceding the leadership of Samuel the prophet, Shmuel HaNavi, we see too, when the Philistines, the Plishtims, not the Palestinian vessels, but the Plishtim or the Philistines, had conquered Israel at that time and had taken captive the Ark of the Covenant, they were afflicted with all different types of sufferings, which you can learn more about by going to the book of Samuel, Navi Shmuel, Shmuel Aleph, Book of Samuel, Book 1. Now, with that being said, that among those who were brought as prisoners, they were not brought to the temple. So Nebuchadnezzar, according to Rav Sadia, another great Torah sage, that the prisoners weren't brought as tribute or to give praise to the idol. They were brought there for what we'll learn further on, what would be their fate. Chapter 1, verse 3, then we see that there would be something that could be done with the Jews who were taken captive, especially those of royal seed and from the nobles, as it's written in chapter 1, verse 3 in the book of Daniel. The king told Ashpenaz, the chief of his officers, to bring from the children of Israel, from the royal seed and from the nobles, from the crumbs of the creme, I guess as you say, and in these days. And he had given the instruction to Ashpenaz, who was actually the chief of his officers, and the language used to describe Ashpenaz was that he was Rav Sarisov. He was the head of his chief of his officers. But the word Saris usually is associated with the concept of a eunuch. A man, or heaven forbid, Shalom Neda, we should know such things, was emasculated. But it happened to be, blessed souls, that in antiquity, those who were the kings and the viceroys of countries of ancient times would employ eunuchs to administer in their court. I guess this would be for what reason why? I haven't gotten a reason yet. For obvious reasons, when they were maintaining their harems, we could understand. But stam, just for, to be emasculated and to have responsibilities other than running the harems of the concubine, the place where the concubines were kept, I'm not exactly sure. If I ever find out about it, Lineta, without a vow, I'll try to share this with you. Now, the Al-Shik understands, as it relates to the children of Israel, from the royal seat, from the nobles, Nebuchadnezzar's primary interest in the nobility was because of the fact they were from of Jewish descent. And apparently, it seems to be implied here by the Al-Sheikh that he had not necessarily had interacted with Jews up until the point he had conquered Jerusalem or Judea. But the Al-Sheikh asserts that he had heard about the fabulous wisdom of the Jews and wished to utilize it. Now, of course, the ancestors of the Jews, Abraham Avinu, the original Jew, because the word, the name Jew, as understood in Talmudic tractate Megillah, is one who is in denial of idolatry. And the prime example of someone who was in denial in a private and public manner was Abraham. And one of his most public demonstrations of denying idolatry was, in fact, when he had a one-on-one encounter and defeated spiritually, intellectually, emotionally, the ancient king of Babylon, Nimrod, by refusing to bow to him. And in the Midrash and the oral Torah traditions have it that he was thrown into a fiery furnace, and 3 days later, because of being protected by celestial beings known as angels, the servants of Nimrod had told him, the king Nimrod, the ruler, one of the first great rulers of various nations, not just his own in Babylon, meaning he had an empire, that Abraham, Ivri, Abraham the Hebrew, the progenitor of the future of the Israelite Jewish nation, had not perished in that fire. And when Abraham was taken out of the fire, that Nimrod actually wanted to bow down to him, and Abraham said, or at that time his name was Avram, because his name would not really truly be changed to Avraham until he had his circumcision at the age of 99. He was much younger than that age. Do not bow down to me. Bow down to the one who spoke and all of creation came to be. Now, the Malbim views each phrase in this verse, in chapter 1, verse 3, as it relates to the categories of Jews. Category number one, from the children of Israel, from the royal seed, and from the nobles, as the children of Israel were Nebuchadnezzar also had spared among the Jews amongst the more common people, and also from the royal seed and the nobles, that the common Jews were to be used as servants, and the royal descendants would eventually serve as officials and advisors. Now, what was the qualification for those eventually who would serve as advisors to Nebuchadnezzar, being that he was the flower or the power of all civilization at that point in terms of the military might that he possessed and the wealth that he accumulated through his various conquests? In chapter 1, verse 4, it mentions youths in whom there was no blemish, good-looking, skillful in all wisdom, discriminating in knowledge, and perceptive in learning, and with the stamina to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the script and language of the Chaldeans. So, again, amongst the chosen of the chosen people, those of noble lineage and royal seed, meaning of the house of King David and King Solomon, anyone who was to serve eventually as an advisor to Nebuchadnezzar should not possess the slightest imperfection, as that can apply, as much as that can apply to human beings. Now, the idea that they should be skillful in all wisdom, as it's translated, or translated back into its original language, that this part of the Tanakh, the prophecies, the book of prophecy, prophetic Daniel, was written, umaskilim, skillful in all wisdom, this translation is provided to us, or influenced by the Rambam in his Guide to the Perplexed, who interprets Chochmah as something which encompasses all pursuits of the mind, which implies the native power of the mind, and the fact that they can not only that, use the native power of their mind to use successfully and implement successfully their da'as, their accumulated knowledge. Now Malbim takes another perspective of it and understands that they should be discriminating in knowledge as a type of knowledge not arrived by reasoning, meaning the knowledge of good or bad, because it has to be arrived at though some sort of basic human intuition, and how much more so through a higher mental consciousness, which is known as Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration, or Holy Spirit, or revelation in the form of Nevuah, prophecy. Therefore, we don't find the expression Binu Chachma, understand wisdom, because, according to the Malbim, because wisdom, Chachma, is not to be understood rationally. It's a perceptive capability possessed by the one who has it. Now, we all have blessed souls as something which is inherent to our human existence, because we have something which is called a nefesh ha-sichlis, an intellectual soul, which configures directly, intimately, and to some people more than others, consciously, to their divine image, and to most people, subconsciously. While da'as, knowledge, is referring to that which is arrived through reasoning. Now, when it mentions that these young men would be ultimately selected to be the advisors to the king, would be the Yoda Das, discriminating knowledge, there was Ibn Ezra understands it, another great Israelite sage, literally to be that they would be knowers of thought. They could actually have such a flexibility, a type of consciousness which is reflected in a dexterity of mind, of a mindset, that they knew from the beginning of a sentence what a speaker intended to say. Now, I don't know about you, blessed souls, but I have met such people. I won't give away their names, but I can tell you that I've been blessed in my lifetime to meet more than one individuals who, when you speak a word, or even by looking at them, they can tell you things about yourself that you might have known, but can't understand how they would know it, or you didn't even know certain things, or wondered how did they tell you such things, even though you didn't tell them. For instance, if they tell you something about a relative from 30 years before you even met the person, that they understood their spiritual state. And the fact that they should be perceptive in learning, as written in chapter 1, verse 4, perceptive in learning, to be able to process a systematic body of language, meaning to learn the language and be able to prioritize it, to collate it, and to have it in one's back pocket, so to speak. Another understanding of the phrase "omavinei mada" and perceptive in learning, we're talking about a type of individual of high consciousness who can take their knowledge and articulate it in a fashion that others can receive the transmission of their knowledge. And the Ibn Ezra mentions that there have been wise men throughout the ages who have been able to access high levels of consciousness, but lack the ability to bring that high level of consciousness to be expressed through their tongues, which are another type of pen. So they might have had a great knowledge, but they lack the ability to express in a way of transmitting it to others. Now the last portion of one of the last portions of chapter 1, verse 4, that another qualification of those with the stamina to stand in the king's palace, as brought down by Rashi's elucidation in the Talmudic tractate, page 93, that what Nebuchadnezzar was looking for in his youth of nobility and royal seed among the Israelites, among the Jews, people of Judah, would eventually serve him as an advisor or advisors, he wanted individuals who had the power to restrain themselves from smiling, talking, and sleeping in the royal presence, and also could control their bodily functions while in the presence of the king, meaning they were so attuned in their focus to reasoning out solutions for whatever perplexing questions the king might eventually ask them, or to provide for him advice how to properly administrate over his administration, it would not be tolerated any lacking on the part of those eventual advisors among the Jewish youth of royal seed and nobility. They would have to be able to have total physical control of all of their waking moments in the presence of the king. Pretty high standards that Nebuchadnezzar had established for them. With that being said, Blessed, we're going to end because there's just so much more to talk about. And what I've touched upon is not even the tip of the iceberg of what type of consciousness can be accessed through learning the oral Torah traditions concerning the Book of Daniel. But hopefully this will be an ongoing series of talks. They'll be more impromptu. I'm not going to have it with guests on. I just want to, because this way will give me the accessibility to cull from various teachings from the oral Torah tradition to better share with you how we of Israel understand the written oral traditions as it relates to this wondrous book, the Book of Daniel, within its 12 chapters, contained within it not only the secrets of understanding the ancient Babylonian kingdom and the ancient king Nebuchadnezzar, but also helps us understand how, unfortunately, when those who don't learn about history don't know the source of ancient kingdoms and how they ruled, they can fall to the chicanery and the recapitulation of the ancient kingdoms, as so many assert today, that with all the lack of justice and peace in the world is because there's too many proofs that they can supply as they're being just recapitulations of ancient Babylon and the ancient rule of the ancient ruler Nebuchadnezzar. But in the meantime, blessings, we hope to continue, hopefully in the spirit of Ahav Echad, one love, Goral Echad, one destiny, call on for all us, B'darchi Shalom, in a peaceful way, darchi noam, in a pleasant way, Aham Shik, Bezer Hashem Yitzbarech, to be continued with the help of the Most High. And remember, you can be good, you've got to be good. Why? Because that power is within you. It's in the Sinus Koch, giving off strength to you, power to you, because a Tevet of Lehetiv is the nature of the good to do good. The Creator is source of all good. So we're not going to end off with music. We didn't start with music, but hopefully these teachings of the oral and written traditions of Israel have been music to your ears. L'hamshich, to be continued. Take care, everyone.